This is a program we call Conversation. It's dedicated to the art of good talk. Tonight, our host, Clifton Fadiman, has the pleasure of having as his guest the Honorable Adlai E. Stevenson with Alistair Cook and Bergen Evans. This transcribed conversation started several minutes ago. Our conversationalists are talking about the non-conforming American. Clifton Fadiman is speaking.
You know, Governor, Mr. Cook, Mr. Evans, there's an awful lot of talk these days about conformity and non-conformity. Maybe that's a healthy thing, that there should be as much talk about it as we have. I'm not at all sure that I know what we mean by non-conformity, particularly in the year 1955. Mr. Cook, what do you think a non-conformist is?
Well, of course you touched me on the raw there, because I was brought up in England as with a Wesleyan parson for a father. And nonconformity meant the very methodical conformists of being a Wesleyan.
Governor, it's true, isn't it, that nonconformity in our country has a more general meaning than the one Mr. Cook has explained?
Well, I'm sure it has a much broader meaning than merely religious conformity. I suppose we think of it in terms of the individual who doesn't coincide precisely with his neighbor, either in view, appearance, or attitude, or habit of thought, or we think of it in terms of the larger scene of political conformity. I suppose we even think of total conformity as totalitarianism.
Yes, the opposite of the sort of thing we're striving for in this country. What do you think, Mr. Evans? What would your definition be of conformity?
Well, I suppose, when you come to define conformity, it all depends whether you're looking at it from the viewpoint of the nonconformist or from the viewpoint of the person who disapproves of it. The nonconformist sees himself as a man of intelligence, common sense, courage, and originality. The other man sees him as a crank and sometimes as a fool or sometimes as a dangerous man.
Are you straddling at the moment, or would you like to?
No, I'm quite serious. One man's nonconformity is common sense to him and dangerous folly to another man.
Well, do you think it's really true that there is more pressure against the nonconformist today in our country than there was, let's say, a generation ago, 25 years ago? What do you think, Governor?
My impression is that of late, largely due to the apprehensions that have developed as a result of war and of the threat of war, the insecurity that's come about in the last generation or so, that there has been a multiplication of the pressures towards conformity, yes. Well,
wouldn't you say, Governor, that whenever a group is threatened, as of course we are threatened by disastrous external forces, we begin to act tribally. The tribe draws closer together and sticks closer to its traditional manners and mores, and it feels that anyone who departs from these traditions may be a potential threat.
Wouldn't you agree, Clifton, that the one of the great prices and tragedies of the mounting tensions and fears in the world is that it has made nonconformity, which is another term sometimes for originality, a very dangerous thing, and the world needs it. That is, the world is in such a state that it cannot take advantage of one of the great sources of human betterment.
Progress, which we believe in, of course, is the result of ideas. Ideas are the result of thought. But thought is so often associated with disagreement, and disagreement with conformity, and conformity with heresy, that you finally get around to the point where heresy is subversion, and therefore thought is subversion, and it's much safer not to think.
Well, you don't think we've reached a point as dreadful as that, Governor?
No, I don't think so, but I think this is the ultimate, this is the logical sequence.
Yes, it may be true, but on the other hand, could I introduce this possible paradox, that the nonconformist who wins frequently becomes totalitarian himself? That, for example, our country was founded by Puritans who were nonconformist religiously. But when they came over here, it is true that with all their virtues, they began to impose upon people their own doctrines. They too became very rigid and stern and severe. And yet they originally were nonconformists.
Yes, they had informers who went out and told the Protestant divines of Massachusetts who was not going to church and who had ventured this opinion in a tavern, which is what said Roger Williams, rushing full sanctuary.
Of course, there's no necessary connection whatever between nonconformity and tolerance. You can be a nonconformist and completely intolerant. In fact, I suspect most nonconformists are.
I think so. For example, there's a totalitarian line, there's also a liberal line. Mr. Cook.
The pattern is, I think, with if you say liberals, which is a very bad word.
It
means everything to
a
all
loose
men.
Word.
But a protesting minority takes on a pattern of thought which I suspect is protective coloration against the pressure of the mob or against the pressure of authority. And it's a different kind of pattern.
Well, how would you describe it?
Well, I think protective coloration is the word, that they also have to be protected.
and therefore they band together and organize themselves. Of course, that is the danger. Organized nonconformism becomes, it seems to me, rather dull. Let's take an example from our own history. I suppose the most distinguished nonconformist in our history is Thoreau. He was not an atheist, he was not a communist, he was not a socialist. He certainly was a rabid individualist. But in Concord, he was allowed to live quite happily and freely, though he was thought of as somewhat of an eccentric. How do you think he would have fared today? Mr. Evans, this is more or less in your department, is it?
Well, Thoreau's family, as you know, owned a small lead pencil factory, and that was sufficient to meet the necessities of life. Now, if in 1955 that had become a great lead pencil factory, Mr. Thoreau might be just as much as a harmless individualist as he then was. If, however, today, without the backing of a successful lead pencil factory, he chose to go live on the shores of a pond, he wouldn't last very long because whoever owned the pond would probably have him arrested.
Well, it would be also very difficult for him to find a pond that he could live in the manner that he did in his day. It'd be surrounded with a subdivision now.
Yes, of course. Ponds represent very valuable real estate. Let's take another great American, Abraham Lincoln. I know you've studied his life with great particularity. Do you think of him as a nonconformist type?
Well, I think we all have envisioned him as a nonconformist, as a man who had very distinctive appearance, who had very distinctive manners, who wrote better than anyone of his time, who many think spoke better, and certainly whose ideas were ostensibly different. The fact of the matter was that his ideas reflected the majority opinion that was growing in the North at that time. I mean, his sympathy for abolition, his distaste for the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, and compromise with the extension of slavery. These were majority opinions that were developing, and he rode that wave of successful and growing and prevailing opinion. His methods, however, I would think were exceedingly nonconformist.
Political methods?
Well, I mean, yes, his political methods, also actually what he did in government. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus. He did things that have been challenged at the time and subsequently as perhaps gross abuses of his constitutional powers as president.
Yes.
Staked out whole new areas of exercise of executive authority, and that sort of thing, which were hardly conformity.
Do you think of him personally as a nonconformist, apart from his political conduct? As a human being, do you think he would have been thought of by his neighbors as being odd or unusual or...
Such things as his blacking his own boots, was that merely a frontier coming into the White House which wasn't used to it, or was that a personal eccentricity?
Well, I should think we'd have to, if we could, then we can't, of course, put ourselves back to that time. It's hard to live in the framework of that time, which the frontier was alive with strange and wonderful characters who were not commonplace. After all, the manner in which they lived, what they did, their surroundings, made for individuals. We didn't have standardized clothing. We didn't have complete standardization transportation of stores. The drugstores weren't all alike. Everything we did wasn't more or less standardized in those days, so I think necessarily he looks like an individualist.
Well, John Russell of the London Times, in his remarkable and fine description of Lincoln when he first saw him, was impressed by the man's individuality. That's sort of the central thing. This is an individual human being, a remarkably unusual man, and he was not out to praise Lincoln, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Evans, I once heard you make the point, which is the point I think that the governor made in a different way, that it was perhaps easier to be nonconformist in Lincoln's time because the pioneers, the settlers there, were far apart, each hewing out his own living, as it were, not subject, for example, to economic pressures.
I must intervene to say time and place, Clifton. Well, it was not until they got west of the Alleghenies that they began to be struck with a rough, surly independence of
But it's the west of the Alleghenies American that I'm speaking of.
Yes,
but, Kip, wouldn't you think that any man in a Western settlement could be a nonconformist if he was prepared to get out of town?
Yes, he could always have some place to go.
I mean, you had to take that risk, and there was some place to get lost.
I don't want to ask a question which may impinge on your own trade, Governor, but isn't it true that statesmen and politicians find it a real handicap to exhibit any undue unconventionality?
Well, that's one of the great perils. A statesman or a politician, in my judgment, should be a teacher. This is the purpose of politics in our scheme of things, in government by consent. You have to understand what you're consenting to, and that means that it has to be explained to you by the politician, who is the spokesman of democracy in action, and that, therefore, politics is hazardous enough in itself. It becomes the more so when one takes into account that we often abuse teachers. I believe we asked Socrates to swallow hemlock, didn't we?
Yes, yes, I'm afraid that's...
It's never happened to a Democratic candidate yet, Governor.
Never had to swallow any hemlock?
It's happened to a lot of Democrats.
Of course, many congressmen, if not statesmen, often assume a sort of a superficial eccentricity as some sort of an advertising distinguishing trademark one has seen.
Ah, but
that
that's kind of conformity, too. It's just brand name stuff.
Yes,
a politician, for example, who wears a 10-gallon hat, is conforming to an imaginative pattern in the minds of a good many of his constituents.
Well, the Indian headdress is compulsory, isn't it?
Well, the point I was trying to make, Mr. Fadiman, is in answer to your question, is that conformity becomes almost compulsory in politics.
It does.
Well, just for the reasons that you said, that if you depart too far from the norm, then you become an eccentric, or then you become a fellow of questionable and doubtful wisdom, and certainly not too reliable. On the other hand, if you do conform too rigidly, you can't teach, because you can't express new ideas bravely and courageously.
It's a very thin tightrope that one
it's
has
very
to,
difficult, yes.
to walk to teach the art of government. You were speaking about teachers, Governor. Do you think that in modern primary education today there's too much stress laid on having the child a member of the group? We hear a great deal about children adjusting themselves to the group. Does one run the risk, perhaps, of losing some great picturesque leader owing to the pressures that are imposed upon the child?
Well, I think perhaps we could afford to lose some of the picturesqueness, but I think it's a pity to lose the taste for individuality, for a sense of self-confidence without conforming to the habits and behavior manner patterns of others. And I think that's one of the prices you pay.
I believe in the reports we get on our children, there is some stress on the fact that he has been successful in group work or he has not. And it's implied that if he has not, that is bad for him.
Yeah. It's like the cartoon of the child who'd been punished for misbehavior, as it would have been called, standing there at the blackboard writing, "I must orient myself with the social group. I must orient myself with the social group."
Well, it's all kind of funny, but all the same, that sort of integration with a social group, whatever you call it, reminds me dangerously of the kind of thing that goes on in totalitarian countries. It doesn't seem to me to have its roots in American tradition.
Well, I feel that this is the application of popular psychology and psychiatry to the old American need to form a community. I mean, the sense of neighborhood, it's been slapped on top of it, I think, a little mistakenly. I don't think there's any intention on the part of school boards or parent-teachers association to say this is the way you've got to be and behave and think. After all, the American high school exists not to primarily to train scholars, but to create citizens. Often, and only two generations ago, people who couldn't speak the language. They have to get oriented to a certain community way of doing things. I think this is one of the great things in America. The danger is, as you say, Kip, that it does, in the process, deny individuality or make people afraid of their own individuality.
Well, it may.
Would you feel then, Alistair, as you just implied, that the tremendous growth of this great country in this phenomenal period of time required us to have pressures
Absolutely.
Towards conformity stronger than in other countries?
I may be overstressing this point, Governor, but I often wonder whether the one who is nonconformist isn't the chap who gets into trouble, rather than the man who perhaps has voted socialist all his life. I think that sort of thing is tolerated by the community without much difficulty.
I find a great pressure towards conformity in the worlds that I've lived in, of various kinds, and one that has disturbed me a good deal is it's very natural, it's implicit, I suppose, in all human society, and that is everyone's thirst to belong to a more exclusive group,
yes.
towards the inner circle, the ring, whatever it is. You know, this, the price of progress towards the inner circle of exclusivity, of perhaps it's a form of snobbery, is usually the surrender of some independence of judgment, of thought, of behavior, of attitude. And as you pay this price more and more and more, you tend to conform more and more and more, until finally you find, so in so many communities, people who think and act and feel very much of a pattern. And I do think that this tends to discourage, and also it's an endless business because you lose a great deal of your own self-reliance and many of your own resources. When you feel as though you have to conform and submit to the pattern of the community.
Governor, has the odd chap, the odd man, ever been tolerated in any community at any time?
That I don't know. I suppose radicalism, as we would, if we could call it that, has always had a hard time. I think I remember some words that, was it Maeterlinck once who wrote about the Spanish Inquisition? And he said the conservative man of the time would have said that they were killing too many. The radical man would have said they shouldn't have killed any.
Yes.
Isn't that right? Yes. Something like
yes.
that.
Yes.
So if you step very far, even if you're stepping in the right direction, away from the norm or the pattern, you're going to be in trouble, I agree.
I think, Kip, that, you know, the first point you made about the threat from the outside, which in frontier settlements was possibly the threat of the Indians or was the threat of whatever lay inside the forest belt,
yeah.
Produces a necessary protective impulse to behave as a community.
Mm-hmm.
It occurs to me that a good deal of the pressures that we at this table seem to resent towards conformity of thinking and behavior and opinion today are exactly the same reflex that we feel so threatened from outside, and especially not by the mystery of the forest, but by the mystery of this mushroom cloud, that there's almost a mystical, an instinct of self-preservation that makes people collect together. They belong to that nation which is the fighting nation. And I think, in a sense, this is part of the psychology of the Cold War, that I think from a very good human impulse, from a very understandable human impulse, we tend to want to come together and distrust the strange man.
Alistair, it follows from what you say, then, that this may be a transient phase.
Yes, I think it could well be. I think if the Cold War was unfrozen and there was any guarantee that we would not be atomized in 10 minutes, yeah. that people might decide that they could be strange and odd and angular and sharp and individual.
Would you agree with me, Alistair, then, that greatness, which is latent in so many human beings, can never be conventional. That is, you cannot be an ordinary man and be an extraordinary man. Now,
unless you're a lunatic,
but the pressures that you have suggested towards frightening people into insisting on conformity for their own self-preservation is endangering then one of mankind's most valuable, probably the most valuable asset we have, which is human originality and unusualness and talent and so on. And with these threats coming, we've still got to have these people, and our great problem is how do you defend yourself as a group and how do you protect this very valuable asset? I don't know the answer.
Mm. You folks have been talking as if we were facing a kind of intellectual disaster in our country. I wonder whether it's fair to accuse us of being conformists when conformism is a general and universal trend today.
Well, but there are some very threatening overtones, Clifton. That investigation of private endowments seems to me to have some very disturbing things.
Yes, Governor, did I interrupt you?
Well, I was, Evans referred to the report, I think, of the Rees
Yes, that's what
committee
I had in mind, yes.
That investigated foundations.
Yes.
It had a sentence in it that I think is one that's a very significant sentence along the line of what you were saying. And if I could I read it to you, Mr.
Of course, Governor.
It said, the trustees of the tax-exempt foundations should be very chary of promoting ideas, concepts, and opinion-forming material which run contrary to what the public currently wishes, approves, and likes.
Yes.
This is tantamount to saying, don't develop any new ideas that are not already part and parcel of the mores and the attitudes.
Yes, Governor, but
now this is the very purpose for which foundations in large measure exist.
This seems to be a very high and important body to have issued such an extraordinary statement as that. It's not a question of merely village vindictiveness or some such nonsense as that. This is a responsible body.
Yes, I think it represents a certain amount of responsible sentiment, too, but I don't think necessarily the majority sentiment. I was reading in Current Look magazine, there's a series on the nonconformist in America. One of the things that they seem to have discovered is that most people think that Americans today feel as free to say what they think as they used to. In other words, this general sentiment around the country is that we're about as free-thinking and independent-thoughted as we ever have been. I'm just wondering whether we around this table aren't exaggerating these pressures.
I have a number of friends in minor government positions in Washington, and I can tell you, no.
How about college students, Professor Evans?
The amount of fear of new ideas that a college student has, Mr. Cook, would require some new instruments to measure it, I think.
Do you really think it's as bad as that?
No, there are no. But the college students are in America, cross-section of the upper two-thirds of the society, and they share all the opinions. On the whole, they're more conservative than the nation as a whole. There aren't very many flaming youth or wild radicals that I have encountered in college.
Do you suppose the fact that nonconformity impairs employment opportunities could have anything to do with that in colleges?
I expect, sir, it's because it impairs their social life. That is, the students are still adolescents, they're still children, and of course children feel pressures towards conformity so terribly. Yes.
I saw a personnel pamphlet issued by one of the largest corporations in America, one of the better ones, I've always thought, the other day, Mr. Fadiman. It shall be nameless, advising students how they ought to behave in college if they wish to be employed in private industry after they got out of college, and I'd just like to read you something it said. Personal views can cause a lot of trouble. The isms are out. Business being what it is, it naturally looks with disfavor on any wild-eyed radical or even the moderate pink. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure it does. But I'd wonder somehow if we ought to lay this down as a standard.
Well,
where the young man...
Everything depends on the definition of wild-eyed radical or pink. That's the point. I think business is perfectly right in asking that it... that radicals keep away and the wild-eyed pinks keep around. I'm for big business, and if they knew exactly what a radical and a pink is...
Well, I wonder, who determines that?
Ah, that's the question.
On the other hand, surely even big business at the top of somewhere or other needs originality and brains and that...
Just don't say we progress without ideas.
Yes, they're asking for, it seems to me, incompatibles here. They don't want... If they want people for secondary positions, all right, but surely they need someday original thinkers and strong individuals?
I think each... Going back to Kip's point, different nations set up quite different criteria of the fields in which you may be a free man or an individual. And I thought of that because of a phrase that came to me from Dennis Brogan, Professor Brogan, who certainly cannot be accused of being unsympathetic to American life or ignorant about it. And he said, there's one figure that, as you travel around the United States, there's one characteristic figure of the free society that you don't see, and that's the village atheist.
You don't hear him. You wouldn't know him if you saw him.
Now, I just wonder about that. Justice Jackson, who was, rightly lauded in his obituaries a couple of months ago, said something which I didn't see quoted anywhere, which was a dissent he wrote. And this has often occurred to me simply as, again, being a nonconformist religious Englishman. I think it's right that atheists should talk on the radio because they have a point of view, and I'm not worried that they're going to seduce the rest of the country. But he said that the day that, he didn't say it in these words, he was more eloquent, but he said the day that we do not grant people the freedom of irreligion, freedom of religion is in danger. And I believe that's very,
certainly,
very strongly.
That's been consistent with our the thinking in this country since the Bill of Rights, since the Constitution, since the beginning
but,
of things.
But, Governor, don't you think it strikes me that...
As soon as dissent falls into disfavor or is crushed or suppressed or disheartened or discouraged, you're really in peril.
Kip, you were talking about sections in this Look series on conformity.
Yes, yeah, very good
and
series,
and I think
by
that
way.
You have things up your sleeve there about some odd surprises for...
For example, they found that community leaders in any of our American communities are more tolerant of nonconformists than are the rank and file of the population. They're more respectful of civil rights of people whose views they disapprove. Well, that seems to me a good thing, that leadership. It is healthy, isn't it, Governor? Because I do think in the long run the views of responsible...
I think that's true.
You think that is true?
That, yes.
Following along the line of the leadership being more tolerant than the rank and file, Look found out the less educated are less tolerant than the better educated. So it's exactly what the governor said. It comes down to a question of education, essentially.
I would like to ask Governor Stevenson a question. You said earlier that you felt that the final, really great aim of the politician was to use his power to teach, because that was the only way in our society that we could do things our way. I'd like you to suggest to us a couple of politicians or statesmen that you felt have used their position most advantageously.
We were talking a moment ago about Lincoln. I think his efforts to relate what was going on in this country with emerging hopes of multitudes around the world was an example of teaching. I think in the case of Woodrow Wilson, you could very well point out that many of his speeches were calculated to educate a people for the new freedom, as he called it, the new liberalism in this country. And that could be generalized, I suppose, to most presidents.
Some of us could name someone more recently whom we feel comes in that category.
Is it true that eccentricity is more excused in England than it is in our own country? That there's more of a tradition of almost of love for the nonconformist or the eccentric.
Now you said nonconformist, but the love of the eccentric seems to me to be the hobby of American scholars.
Well, let's take Sir Winston Churchill, certainly the greatest living Englishman. Sir Winston, I'm sure, would have no hesitation in doing such an odd thing as taking off his shoes, if he wished, when he walked into a room, if he felt uncomfortable.
Well, he has a sort of royal patent on gestures like that.
But now, Governor, would a leading statesman of our own country ever dare to do so unconventional a thing as that?
In the Hill Country?
Well, it wasn't long ago, he'd not only do that, he'd take off his coat and he'd take off his necktie and open his...
Oh, for political purposes.
Collar. Certainly.
Also for his own personal convenience.
Do you mean to show off? I think in my part of the country. I think that's disappearing. I do. I think there's much more standardization of behavior in this country. Yes I do.
I think it may be that the English have so long a tradition of stability that they think they can afford a certain amount of eccentricity.
The eccentrics are drawn largely, that I saw in England, from the assured classes, those whose position was so secure.
Formally assured
classes. They didn't regard themselves as eccentrics in any way. They just felt that other people were being a little unreasonable and absurd from time to time, and that they would pursue the proper course.
But certainly in dress we see much less of the... of the string tie and the flowing hair and all of the things that we used to see that people used either for eccentric advertising purposes or because they found it agreeable or because it reflected the pattern of behavior in their region. Conformity really is overtaking us, I think. And I don't think it's a bad thing in dress and appearance and that sort of thing.
Not if it conduces to comfort. I'm all for it.
Yeah. But as it goes along, I think it also is implicit in it is the recognition of total conformity in other respects.
Oh, well, that's the danger. Do you think there is implicit in it that...
Well, as we get less accustomed to variations in any form from the norm, we get less tolerant of variations in any form from the norm.
Governor, I was going right along with you there until it suddenly struck me that maybe we have to play up uniqueness and the unity of our own societies, as communications make us see many more people around the world, and in the United Nations, for instance, you have to get used to people who have totally different habits and different speech and different conventions and different days when they may meet and different foods and so on, so that the actual eccentricity, if you like, that we're faced with are much, much wilder eccentricities than you'd get inside any region or inside any country.
That's possibly true.
Could I just... say that I think we have been tossing this word eccentricity and as the other side of the coin of nonconformity. I think it's a danger of confusing the easily tolerated eccentric or eccentric community, which is so small and so odd that it threatens nobody, and the protesting member of the community.
The man who makes a fuss.
The man who lives in the town, works for the town, is on the school board and protests. That's the man, I think, that we've said should have more rights than we suspect some people
quite
do.
Right.
On the whole, you three gentlemen think that the pressures toward conformity have become a little greater during the last 10 or 15 or 20 years than any of us would like to see. And as Alistair remarked in the course of the discussion, this may simply be the consequence of external pressures that's threatening the safety of the tribe. Remove those external pressures and perhaps we will relapse once again into our picturesque and colorful oddness that we're so proud of.
You've been listening to Conversation, a transcribed series of programs dedicated to the art of good talk.